Hi, Tanya. Hi, Ryan.
Hey.
Hey, what's up?
So we've been thinking about it, and we just think you two would get along.
That sounds great.
Yeah, sounds good. How annoying is my constant coffee?
Slurping? Yeah. I think you might want to pull back on the slurp.
Okay.
Like, I too shall slurp, but it's going to be an intricate maneuver in which you can mute yourself, but the only problem is if you mute yourself, then, like, you have to remember to unmute, and,
yeah,
like,
that's not going to happen.
That's a lot. Okay. Yeah. Oh, so we're on a podcast now, I guess. Hello, everybody. Welcome to I Think You Two Would Get Along. I'm Trin from Kickstarter. I'm the digital outreach lead, and this is Anya, my cohort. Anya, could you tell people about yourself?
Sure. My name is Anya. I'm the senior games outreach person. I'm one of the people that you talk to when you need advice for your Kickstarter, want to talk about your Kickstarter, and I probably stalk you on Twitter if you have thought about running a Kickstarter project.
She's our resident creep here at Kickstarter, and she does an amazing job. And today in the podcast, we've got two people we think are going to get along. We've got two people who are running dating sims currently on Kickstarter. Tanya Short is running the dating sim slash fighty game Boyfriend Dungeon. Tanya, if you want to give us just two, maybe one to three, like a tweet length sentence about who you are.
I'm the captain of Kit Fox Games, a small studio here in Montreal, Canada. And we've put out a few games like Moon Hunters and now Boyfriend Dungeon and The Shrouded Isle last year. And I'm originally from California.
Fun. Do you know any French?
Petit peu. But not great for how long I've been here, for sure.
They speak English as well. I'm sure you're fitting in wonderfully. Ryan Wehmeyer.
I made a lot of money making a game called Oregon Trail, which is a zombie parody of Oregon Trail. And then I've been losing that money for 5 years.
Wonderful.
And then at some point I made a small game called Max Gentleman, and it was like extreme gentleman arcade game. And then I've always joked about making a dating sim. Time to make a dating sim before I have to go get a real job, and it seems to be going pretty well, so maybe I won't have to get a job.
This is I Think You Two Would Get Along, which is a podcast where Ani and I will interview two games creators who are on Kickstarter, have done Kickstarters, to make them be friends. We're going to try and force you guys to be friends within the next, like, 45 minutes. There's no escape. We're going to go through the normal stages of making a friend, which will start with small talk, because you don't just meet somebody and tell them your life story. You ask them how the weather is. And then we're going to move on to medium talk, which is the medium of games, and that's really Anya's category, where she knows the most about. And then we're going to end with large talk, which is a bunch of very big questions that you definitely don't have the answers to. Things such as, what is your life philosophy? What does it take to be a good human being? Where do you think the world is heading? No one knows these things, but we shall ask them. So, Ryan, do you feel like you are your own boss, or do you feel like you just do stuff within these hours and then you feel good?
Oh, no, I mean, I'm definitely my own boss. I feel like a lot of indies are indie because we're bad at listening to other people and doing what they want. Because it's like, sure, I'll do that, but that's wrong. I can do it faster. I can do it better. And every once in a while I'll take contract work. And then halfway through, I'm like, oh, yeah, this is why I'm indie. Ideas are bad.
So how do you reconcile that when you do contract work? Because obviously, like, you still occasionally do contract work. So do you just kind of have to be like, okay, I'm taking a back seat. This is not my project. Or is it just kind of like you sneak in the changes you want? How do you feel good about it?
It's a little bit of both. Because a lot of times the people, because I will sometimes get contracted just to do basic programming or design, or sometimes just explore design. And they'll ask for something that is unreasonable or already in the game, or just they have no idea what they're talking about, right? Because a lot of times people who are directing based on their feelings, not based on the actual math or the code. And so sometimes it's like, okay, well, I'm just going to do what's right. Or, you know, every once in a while you get that weird thing where I made this weird gambling app, and he's like, it feels like I'm losing a lot. And I was like, mathematically, it is exactly the amount you asked for. I've run 1 million simulations. And so he's like, well, could you tweak it? And so I just, you know, wait a week, send it back. Here you go. Same thing.
Wow.
You know.
Tanya, captain. How did you become the captain? Did you get, like, voted in, or were you one of the founding members? How'd that work out?
I was the lead founder, I guess. Back when we started in 2013, I put out the call to try to find programmer and artist and try to get a team together for the initial incubator that we joined. So I was the one who's the most experienced at that point with game development. And captain, I don't think the title captain came until a few months later. But it was clear from the beginning I was going to be the designer and lead of the team from both a design and production standpoint.
I feel like you should have a badge or like a varsity letter.
Oh, we made blazers with no. the Kit Fox badge on it. They're really cool.
Oh my god, you nerds, I love it!
I mean, they're even like the Japanese high school blazer style. They're really nice.
That's so awesome.
I come up with the strategies for what the overall products are going to be, but ideas can come from anywhere, and most members of the team are hybrid designers as well. So even though I am the leader of the content and system design, a lot of times the solution to a design problem doesn't need to come from me, or even individual systems can be designed by other people. So for example, in Boyfriend Dungeon, Kira, you can see in the Kickstarter video, she is making all of the combat systems and the combat gameplay, and she has full reign to design on that, and I'm more of a consultant when it comes to that section of the game. So it really depends on what people's interests are and what we can kind of separate out for each person.
So you mentioned interests, and I'm going to do a very hard segue into this. Before we started recording, our producer Alex was mentioning that there might be like a rare Pokemon sighting. Ryan, you got very excited about this.
Yeah, because
you like the Pokemons.
Yeah,
Pokemon.
I'm playing Pokemon Go, despite it being one of the worst apps ever.
That's not harsh on Pokemon Go.
It's kind of like my pastime. It's like when you play it, like all the enjoyment comes from complaining about it.
Like many things in life.
There's this one great example I heard a long time ago, and I'm going to butcher it, but it was talking about, like, let's say you make a game that sells a million copies or more, and you have a bug in the game that makes people angry for 15 minutes. Multiply that by like a million, and you've wasted like 10 years of human life in anger. And so when I think about Pokemon Go, I think about how I'm always mad at it. And even though, yeah, sure, a lot of people have downloaded it, I feel like it's brought more stress and anger to humanity than joy.
Well, speaking of stress and anger, what's your favorite Pokemon?
Sorry, I'm really good at depressing topics.
No, you're doing great, but what's your favorite Pokemon? This is Smeltuck.
Yeah. Do you have one?
I mean, it can be your favorite Pokemon, or it can be a Pokemon that you feel you identify with. For example, Chespin is the Pokemon I identify with. He's got big teeth. He wears a cute little hood. He seems very chipper. Tanya, if you have your favorite Pokemon and or Pokemon that you identify with, please bring it to the table.
I think my little brother's favorite was Charizard. So just to annoy him, my favorite was Charmander because, you know, he's way less powerful and way more cute. But he has all that potential to someday be a dragon. So I wanted to believe in him and his dreams.
I like that. It's like rooting for the underdog.
Yeah, the Undermander.
Ryan, you have to give me a Pokemon.
This is like, you know, picking children. There's like 800 of them, but
you have 800 children.
I have 800.
You have 800 tiny children that fight for you.
I keep them in balls.
Keep them in balls.
Oh, we won't tell the other 799. Just pick one.
Okay, that's good. Yeah, I'm gonna have to go with my default. I don't love this answer, but Articuno, like legendary ice bird. Just I think because when I was young, I thought ice types were cool, and he was one of the legendary birds, and I always thought he was cool. I used to run a website on GeoCities called Articuno's Cavern.
Wow.
And I was
like, oh my god, you nerd!
Yeah, it was my Pokemon / anime website.
Amazing.
nerd. I love this.
Yeah.
I think both of you kind of mentioned like your younger selves. Describe yourself your junior year of high school specifically.
Well, first I have to clarify that I was 15 as a junior in high school. I did skip a grade, so I was a little bit young, a baby. But I was just freshly varsity on the tennis team at school. And I think I had just given up on my dreams of becoming valedictorian because I'd gotten my first B+ and I'd had a long cry about it. And it was for the best, eventually. I could learn to give up on perfection. I think I was a wannabe secret goth, though. Like, I had a gothy boyfriend at the time, and we'd go to Disneyland and scoff at everything. But I still dressed like a straight-A jock kind of thing, yeah.
An athlete and a perfectionist. You can be both.
I was both. Now I am neither a perfectionist nor an athlete. So that's what happens to the Hermiones of the world. They become indie developers.
But you are an anime-haired captain of a video game team, which I feel is a very good next evolution.
It is like the next Pokemon step is coming to terms with your inner goth self.
This came full circle.
Our anime captain.
I'm proud of us. This is great. Ryan, your junior year of high school.
I think if you think about the average game developer and then think about them when they were 17, that was probably me.
Okay.
I was very into anime. I think I was the president of the anime club at my high school. I had really long hair, like past my shoulders.
What?
Yeah. Because one of my, like, there's an anime character with long hair, and I was like, I want to be cool with that guy.
Oh my God, I love it. Was it your natural color? Did you
Okay. I've never colored my hair. I drew webcomics back then.
Ooh, me too.
Yeah. I have two different webcomics that you can find. Please don't find them. I'm pretty sure they still exist. I think I was putzing around in high school. I don't remember what I was using. I know that in junior high, I was like using RPG Maker to make games and programming games on my calculator. So I'm not sure by high school what I was using. I was maybe Game Maker. I don't know. But yeah, I've kind of always been doing this. I'm boring.
Follow-up question. Tell me everything about the webcomics you made.
Oh, boy.
I honestly don't think I ever put mine on the web because I realized after two pages what a huge amount of work comics are.
Oh, yeah.
But I think I drew one or two pages of some sort of surreal lizard mage visiting a dream castle or something like that. That's all I remember, really. I bet my mom has it in her attic. But
I feel like, again, like this is very... You've evolved in your Pokemon over and over again. Like, it's very good. Brian, like, I know you don't want us to find them, and we won't. No one listening to the show will Google your comics.
It's very easy, actually.
I'm Googling it right now.
Yeah.
We will never, don't worry, we won't out you.
They're super cringy. Like, I mean, anything you make when you're young sucks. But yeah, no, I think from freshman, all through high school, I think I did hand-drawn comics. And then, like, my friends who I would, like, wrangle in to, like, be my quote-unquote editor. But really, I just wanted them to read me the stories and tell me they were good, and then I'd make them draw them cool and stuff like that.
But, you know, I think that it's cool that you are honest with yourself, that it's like, I just wanted to write a story and have my friend draw cool art and tell me that the story was good, because that's what everybody wants, you know? Like I was going to say, that's what everybody wants when they're 17 and they're just starting to make things. But, like, I still want that, too. I want people to tell me I'm doing a good job. I want somebody to give me a report card that has an A+. That is what I want.
I'll get you one later.
Thank you. Yeah. Speaking of huge nerds, Tanya.
Excuse me.
So you mentioned that you got your B+. What class did you get the B+ in?
Oh, you know, that was the most frustrating thing. It was a class that I felt I was excelling in, which was English literature. And actually my bachelor's degree ended up being English literature as well. So I was extra betrayed.
Oh my God.
By this teacher. It was because I turned in my report a few hours late and she wanted to teach me a lesson.
Professor was conspiring to destroy your education.
Yeah. How dare your professor conspire to destroy your education?
Yeah. My English teacher, unfortunately, wanted to teach me a lesson about being too perfectionist and wanting to have my way all the time. So when I was really late with my extremely detailed report by a few hours, my mother drove herself in with my report in hand and handed it in as soon as we could. But it still was docked 15 points for lateness. And I cried for many weeks.
So I feel that this is bullshit. First of all,
Mrs. Valero, I hope you're listening.
I hope she's listening too. Listen, Mrs. Valero, I've got something to say. If you have a young student who is showing so much potential and is trying so hard, I don't think that it's your right to teach that lesson. You know, like, you're a freaking high school student. You're balancing a lot of things. You wanted to be valedictorian. I'm angry at this teacher on your behalf, even if you're not.
I do value your loyalty and defense, but I mean, I'm sure I was completely insufferable. Like, imagine Hermione Granger, but even more clueless and arrogant and self-righteous. Like, it was probably pretty bad. Yeah, no, I probably deserved it, and I was probably a much more well-adjusted person afterwards. So,
well, I think that's cool that you grew from the experience. I, however, will continually hold a grudge. Let's talk about games, because the both of you are making dating sims. So, Anya, if you've got some questions about games, game dev, game situations, kissing games.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. I have a ton of questions, actually. Both of you are repeat creators, which means that you've run more than one project on the site. So I have some very specific questions about that. But my first question is, and this is for either one of you, Why do you keep coming back to Kickstarter?
Well,
good question.
Ever since we ran our first one back in 2014, people would ask me regularly if I would come back to Kickstarter. And a few other platforms tried to pitch me, but it's always been an extremely positive experience for us. Our community around Moon Hunters was extremely positive. They were extremely supportive. And, I mean, even money aside, we felt like it was an extremely big value add for our whole dev team's morale. Everything was so much smoother after we ran the Kickstarter that it seemed inevitable that we would run another one when we had a game that made sense for the platform.
Awesome. Ryan, what about you?
So the very first one we ran was for a very small goal because I just wanted to buy a Unity license, which was like $3,000. And then it kind of exploded. Well, in relative terms, it made like, I don't know, like five times its gold or something. And I was like, oh, wow, this makes me feel like we're on to something. And then the second one was like, okay, this game doesn't need any money because it's kind of small. It's more of just like a fun kind of marketing campaign. And I was really just selling fun loot at cost. And it was kind of just a way for fans to engage with the product. And so this time around, it's kind of a combination of both. Like, I don't need extra money, but it sure would help because I'm way over budget. And then on top of that, it's like I want to find our audience and find, like, the people that are really into it, figure out what people like about it, see how much more time I should be investing on it and whatnot. And so it's a great way to gauge what your audience is and what parts of the game they like. And if you're onto something smart, because, you know, I could just finish the game in a month and release it right now if it wasn't working versus, you know, okay, maybe I spend more time on it and people really like more characters, so I should do that, et cetera. And so I don't know, I'm not a big fan of, say, releasing an alpha and working on the game as you before you release it and letting people play it. And it seems like too much work for me. And a Kickstarter is kind of a nice, like, 1 month focus group, if you will, without even having to release the game.
What Ryan was saying is one of the biggest reasons why we do it is getting to practice the marketing, because, you know, we don't have millions of dollars to spend on market tests and focus groups and all that kind of thing that bigger companies do. So for us, it's extremely valuable to just be able to practice. Like, we make a trailer, we make press announcements, we try to pitch it, and then we see how it goes. And so we use PAX that way too. But Kickstarter is perfect because it's actually in kind of the same format that our eventual Steam page will be, which is something people can link to each other, and we can see how effective our taglines are, and that you can't put a price on that.
If you know what you're going to be selling the game as, it helps you focus your design because, you know, that's something you need to actually deliver on, whatever your promise is. And another thing I was going to say.
Oh.
Yeah, another really good point. So just be impressed by whatever I was going to say.
It seems like there's been sort of a rise in dating sims over the last, like, year or two. Why do you think they're so popular?
I don't understand why they weren't popular 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I honestly feel like it's bizarre, and it's an artifact of, I don't know, a macho culture or something. Because back when I was in school 10 years ago, I thought for sure that by now there would be dating sims everywhere. They would be a normal genre alongside everything else. But no, here we are in 2018, and it's still the new trend that's up and coming. So it's hard for me to imagine the reasons why it hasn't exploded up until now. I know that there's been a couple of successes, which is great. I hope that continues. Maybe with our games, that'd be even better.
Right? Right? Let's keep that upward trend.
Yeah, people get braver when there's been a couple successes. Like, we were working on Boyfriend Dungeon from last March, so it's been about a year and a half now. But I know a lot of people didn't start making theirs until after they saw, oh, look, Dream Daddy managed to make a success. And it's not just a one-note joke. It's a real game. It has real depth and writing. So you can't just dismiss it as a one-off joke, which is great.
As much as I've always wanted to make a dating sim, the only reason I'm making one now is because it's like a cold, hard, calculated market analysis of what I think I can make that I would also enjoy to make that will make money. And so, yeah, there's just like a whole bunch of conflicts of things that have been happening recently. Obviously, we have some sort of big name dating sims that people really like, Dream Daddy, How to Fool Boyfriend, and just like a batch of other ones that are also kind of in this actually like safe for work realm. And then on the other side, you have Patreon adult games starting to finally explode because it's a place where people who used to kind of just do this as a hobby have found a way to make kind of revenue. And so it's, I think, also you've got maybe like a third prong, which is with the accessibility of tools like Twine to allow people to write interactive stories and start to kind of figure out their voice and how to craft relationships through, you know, like a game's narrative. When you put those all together and you start seeing these successes, it's like swirling together to the point where now you have people that have the talent and the money and are willing to take the risk and hit the market with something. And then, you know, the audience is starting to realize that that's what they want. You know, they play one because they saw it and they're like, oh, that's hilarious. And then they play it and they're like, oh, this is actually, you know, good.
Yeah.
So it's just like this side of the industry is starting to kind of prove itself in groundswell. And yeah, I hope to keep that trend going.
Yeah, that totally makes sense.
So I played the crap out of Dragon Age Origins, which is not considered a dating sim, but it like is, know, because you like kiss people and then you like kill demons with them, which is like the best thing I've ever heard of. And so like as I played these BioWare, like very character driven, very story driven, very romance driven games, and then realized there are games that have just kissing. That's outstanding. But you guys both have other components to the kissing as well.
Yeah.
How do you meld those two together? Because, like, you know, killing demons and kissing, those, I guess, are not, you know, diametrically opposed enough that there's a game about it. So sexy business is cold, hard cash and cold, hard kisses.
Cold, hard bods.
Ew. What?
No, that's the weapons you're thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
Very true.
For me, I don't actually generally prefer a purely narrative game. I'm a very impatient gamer. I can't read for too long, but I absolutely love Dragon Age, Mass Effect, Persona, or Harvest Moon, or the new indie one, Stardew Valley. You know, I enjoy the relationships in those, and even though they're very surface level, it's still just like, it's a pleasant interaction. You know, like, there's plenty of games where it's like, kill thing, get experience, better at kill thing, and I just also enjoy be nice to someone, gain affection, they're nicer to you.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel. I feel like we have so many different progression systems, and even the most shallow relationship system has been so satisfying for me in the past that I think it should be a basic form of gameplay that we see more often, because it is a core human enjoyment to look for other people's company.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I just wanted to make a game where I could play with characters and play with affection and sexuality, and try not to make it skeezy, because I feel like a lot of people are very uncomfortable with different levels of adult games, and so ours is going like right up to the precipice. And then on top of that, we just recently reached a goal where we're going to make a version that shows all the naughty bits. But I still, you know, I still obviously want to be respectful and inviting to as many people as possible. And so yeah, I just wanted to make like a game that included sexuality in a way that feels comfortable and safe, but still tantalizing. And that's obviously very hard, because I've never done that before.
Ryan, since you are a one-person team and you are...
Relatively
one-person team, essentially a solo dev, and you're running all these projects and you're doing all this game development, what's sort of your process in running a Kickstarter project, and what's your process in being a solo dev? Do you have a team of people that works with you for like each Kickstarter project, or do you have like part-time people? What does that process look like?
For the previous two campaigns, I had a business partner, and I generally am the kind of type who like I put everything together and I say, revise this, like edit it, you know, someone to bounce ideas off of and get opinions on and whatnot. This time around, it was just me. I like to tell people, if they're going to run a Kickstarter, you have to assume it's going to be at least 2 full man months. One month of getting it ready and 1 month of running it. And then, you know, obviously at some point you have to fulfill the stuff and maintain relationships with your fan base at that point. But yeah, it was just kind of, I just looked up a bunch of other dating sim Kickstarters that I liked and what I liked what they did. I looked up ours and what parts of that I liked. And I just kind of Frankensteined it into something that I was proud of. You know, I would just every day I would just update the page, look at what I didn't like and keep updating it with a launch date in mind. Yeah. And then I just got to a point where I was like, this feels good. People say it looks impressive. I'm ready to go.
Yeah, it's amazing what you see when you don't look at something for 2 days and then come back to it. It looks so different.
One of the funniest and strangest things I hear a lot from our community is, oh, video games are dead on Kickstarter. Video games don't fund on Kickstarter. Yeah. And you, in particular, are sort of a perfect case of someone who funded in, what was it, 7 hours?
6 and a little bit, yeah.
Did you anticipate that?
We hoped, of course. And in my heart, I was really gunning for 150K, but it's funny because the days and hours before we pressed launch, everybody on the team compared our estimates of how we thought it would do. And everyone's estimates were much lower than numbers we had discussed because we all suddenly realized, well, what if? You know, you don't know. It's all out of your control, mm-hmm. and you don't want to be too disappointed. And you know, maybe we'll just barely get funded, and that'll be okay, too. That would be fine. Like, that's far from the worst-case scenario, right? It's hard to say. I do feel like people are a little bit more skeptical. You have to have a little bit more trust built up with your community for them to take you at your word on Kickstarter now than maybe 4 years ago. But mm-hmm. I don't think people are less generous when they do trust you. So we felt a similar outpouring of support and love from our community that we did then as we did in 2014.
How much of that, too, was all the events that you all did? Like, every PAX that I've seen, like, basically what were, it's like August 27th or something like that. And I think I've seen you at every single, or at least someone from KitFox, at every single event, major gaming event that has happened. How was sort of the response from, like, the con community?
Oh, it's been great. KitFox, we do kind of do some market analysis and make sure that what we're making is somewhat appealing to, you know, whatever you could call the core gamer demographic, which to me means people who go to PAX who have a Steam account. And, you know, as long as we make games that aren't alienating to them, and we try to act like, you know, real humans because we're, you know, we're not robots, we're not aliens, we're people. And so on the show floor, you know, we try to be as people-like as possible, whatever that means. And in our newsletters and tweets and everything like that, it is something we actually talk about how it's really easy to kind of step back and become cold if you're not careful, because you are talking to, you know, 10,000 people. But I think it's been really good. We really connect with people one-on-one, and then, you know, over time, those build up into thousands of people. It's been good.
That's awesome. Tanya, you're based in Montreal, and Ryan, you're based in Chicago. Tanya, I'd definitely be interested to kind of learn what that games scene community, however you want to call it, sort of is in Montreal. And Ryan, I'm super curious to know about the sort of game dev community in Chicago.
Montreal's amazing. I moved here 8 years ago, and when I came in, I would go to these local meetups, and literally every kind of game developer was there. You'd have full indies, but you'd also have amateurs and hobbyists and AAAs and academics and all of them just mixing in the same space and encouraging each other and cheering each other on. So you'd have, you know, somebody shows or talks about what they did on, I don't know, Lara Croft or Assassin's Creed or whatever, and then you'd have somebody else talking about this prototype they made in a game jam over the weekend, and someone else is talking about designing a Kickstarter for the next week. And it was just a really, really vibrant group of people that I felt were all artists, and it was very, very motivating for me. Even at the time, I was working at a larger company, and then later went to start KitFox. And I think that remains true now. I think that a lot of people get moved here by the big companies because they are the ones who can afford work visas and importing and immigration and all that kind of thing. But then once they're here, they don't leave. They stick around and make games any way they can. And so it's a really diverse, wonderful group.
Ryan, tell us about the Chicago community.
A lot of our community kind of founded on the closing of Midway Games and EA Games. Oh, what is that, almost 10 years ago? I can't even remember time. And so a lot of those people kind of like made some smaller, like medium-sized professional studios. And then at the same time, that was right around when colleges started making game programs. And so I had been going to college just assuming I was going to work at Midway Games. I bought like an old copy of Mortal Kombat 3, and I was like, this is going to go on my desk when I work at Midway. And then I graduated and there were no more companies. And so I just had to become indie. And so a lot of people from kind of like my chunk of time worked a little bit at a few smaller studios, you know, maybe 30-man studios, and then maybe bounced off and made some small indie studios. At some point, I made a co-working space because I needed the community. When I was indie for a little while, I started to get just, I wouldn't say lonely, but just like anxious to have a different setting to work in.
Sometimes you just need somebody to bounce an idea off of to know you're not insane.
Yeah, exactly. So like, especially being a solo-ish dev, like I have a lot of people in the community that I have worked with before at other jobs, and we can, you know, be relatively honest with each other, and that's really helpful for all of us, and just like learning a lot of the ropes and helping each other with weird bugs that come up when you're working on a game. There's this like weird hodgepodge of people that work at these kind of medium tier studios, and then I feel like most of the successful indies worked at those studios for 2 or 3 years and then got enough professional experience, but then also got enough hatred in their soul for a real job that it fuels them through being indie.
Yeah, I just went for the first time last year, actually, or this year, because I attended Train Jam. It takes you from Chicago all the way to San Francisco, and getting to meet the local Chicago devs there before Train Jam was awesome.
Oh, yeah. So actually, I'm assuming, did you attend BitBash?
I did last year. Well, the little one, I'm told.
Itty Bitty Bash.
Yeah, there was another organization that I was one of the founders of and have recently stepped back on.
Alongside running KitFox, I also started Pixels, which is a woman in games, a feminist nonprofit, essentially, to help more women make games and survive working in games. And it's interesting to see how you can't do that for all of your free time forever. There has to be some amount of time that you are okay with stepping back. And I don't know, it's just interesting to see in different cities the way that the different, I call them cohorts, but the different generations of game creators learn from each other and from the previous cohort. And it seems like the tone of that is very, very different depending on who decides to take the lead. Even in a giant community like Montreal, if one person steps forward and takes lead on something, it will have a vastly different outcome and a different atmosphere to it than if someone else takes it in a different direction. So I don't know. I just don't think that you should feel bad for stepping back, or you sounded slightly apologetic. So I just wanted to say that you should feel really proud for the time that you put in there, and it's not your responsibility to do it forever. But I'm sure you already know that. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to say.
Yeah, no, nice to hear.
That's actually a really good segue into a question that I wanted to ask. Tanya, I know you're very passionate about this topic. And Ryan, I'm definitely curious to kind of hear your input here. So one of the biggest topics that we hear in indie game development, one of the issues that we hear about a lot is crunch. So I'm curious to know, Tanya, as someone who is the captain of the team, how do you manage crunch, not just for yourself, but also as someone that's responsible for, like, I think it's like 4 other people?
Well, now 7, actually.
And Ryan, I'm curious to know, how do you manage any sort of like crunch issues that come up as a relatively solo dev?
Well, I've tried turning the conversation away from actually the word crunch, and there's a good reason for this. This isn't just semantics, but focusing more on burnout specifically, because it looks different to different people. The number of hours are different for different people, and it is less about the number of hours you're working and more about how burned out you're getting, because different kinds of tasks can burn you out more if it's not the kind of task you enjoy, or just not the kind of task that you feel comfortable doing. Or if you're doing it in an environment that's exhausting, then you can burn out even if you're only working 30 hours a week. So I have been very forceful about making employees go home sometimes, even co-founders sometimes. And I personally have been putting my maximum at 45 hours to be, you know, a role model of efficiency. But I even have been realizing 45 might be too much, because after 5 years of working 45 hours, it's still exhausting to be putting in that much. So it is really that I don't expect people to work more. I don't hold them accountable for working more. I do hold them accountable for working while they're in the office and while they're on the clock, that they are efficient and effective. And I try to work with them one-on-one to make sure that if they need support, that they can get whatever they need. But to some extent, it is about trusting them with the time that they say they're spending and then making sure they leave.
Crunch is something I don't do. Quality of life is kind of the point of my career. You know, like, I'm not trying to make the best, biggest games as fast as possible to become as famous and rich as possible, because that is a fool's errand and you'll kill yourself. I think your 20s is a good time to experiment with that, but now that I'm, you know, a little past that, I found a very work-life balance is very important. Relaxing is very important. Not having to be productive all the time is very important. And honestly, I'm kind of lazy, so it naturally happens that I just don't crunch. I definitely will, you know, like murder myself for a week before something launches, but that's just kind of natural. I think burnout.
But that's part of why I don't want to talk about crunch itself, is because like a week of putting in towards a deadline isn't burning out, right? Like that's mm-hmm. a week mm-hmm. of working hard, and then nobody's going to say you're burned out.
I mean, honestly, I can burn out from like an hour of writing, like because writing is so hard for me and so stressful that after an hour, I'm like,
oh, interesting.
Okay, one more week until I do that again. Long story short, I just put out a demo for a game because I needed to get it at a certain time. I was like, if it doesn't come out now, it's not going to work. And I needed to write, you know, like thousands of lines of dialogue. And after like the first character was done, I was exhausted. And so like, this is not something I would recommend doing, and something I used to do in college a lot and does not work anymore now that I'm over 30. I just said, all right, all-nighter, here we go. You know, Red Bull, sit down, just get like stream of consciousness writing. And I got a lot of fun, goofy stuff out. But definitely because like my mind was breaking down. And it was, you know, it was fun to do that. But now that I'm older, I'm like, okay, let's not do that again for another 3 years.
The ability to, break down your inhibitions and just write is like half of the goal, you know?
Right.
And some people do that by not sleeping. Some people do that with a glass of wine.
Yeah.
Hopefully the professionals, you know, they figure out how to do it without any of those tools. But I'm doing my best.
Or a responsible amount.
I am not actively studying all the time in my off time, for sure. I mean, I'm watching Brooklyn Nine-Nine right now, and that's not really relevant to anything.
Well, it's
except, I guess, maybe comedy writing.
Yes, it's such fine writing. I'm sorry, I'm so enthusiastic about that show. Good choice.
But it, like in reflection, I can think back on the really good timing of certain jokes and the way they develop certain characters. But in the moment, mm-hmm. I'm really just relaxing before I go to bed. And that's okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm definitely a creative thief. Like everything is inspired by something. every once in a while I hear game developers be like, oh yeah, we found inspiration from something outside of games. And I'm like, all right, screw you. I'm just like, oh, I like Shadow Colossus. What if I made it with zombies, you know? So I'm like creatively bankrupt, but it's okay because people like what I make. So
good work.
I mean, I have enough hobbies. I love playing video games, and that one I feel good about because I can binge on them and then feel like at mm-hmm. least some aspect of it is going to be usable in my professional career, because I can think about how did that make me feel? How did those systems work? How did those systems work 50 hours into the game? Stuff like that. So I never, I don't know. I barely work 40 hours a week, probably because half my work day is putzing around. So, and then, you know, that's my life.
I mean, I think the thing with work too is it's like, okay, yeah, you're working 40 hours a week, but like, are you coding, let's say, like eight to nine hours a day? Mm-hmm. Like, no, you take breaks. Like it's
okay. Just being in the creative environment for 8 hours is all I require of myself.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I wanted to actually ask both of you if you have any questions for each other.
That's a good question.
I want to hear about what is the most difficult relationship to write so far that is in your game. I'm struggling with a few different characters and their flirting styles, and I was curious.
I mean, I spent a lot of time on our game thinking about how the player interacts with the characters and like how... Like, what do I like about the characters in other games? And a lot of other games, it's mostly the characters interacting with each other, and the player gets very little input. It's just like, what do you think, boss? And it's like, murder them or give them hugs. And then it's like, I, the evil character, I'm glad you like the murder them option. And I'm fine with that. Like I said, I'm fine with shallow options. I think for me, the hardest part has just been, so the interaction is almost always with the player. And I try to give the player pretty much full agency. I try not to narrate what the player is doing or thinking as often as possible.
Mm.
And yet I have to write 12 different characters, and I'm definitely not a writer. And so I think my biggest problem personally is creating 12 distinct voices without them feeling too cookie cutter, because I need to separate them, but then they need to be distinct, but varied, and it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, it's the classic ensemble cast problem.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, how do I follow the mechanical formula of character has one heart for you, has five hearts for you, etc., and then copy that 12 times and make them feel like a different journey each time.
Ryan, do you have any questions for Tanya?
I was curious how much of the current game you're working on. The last, you've done a bunch of games with like similar combat, right? Kind of just like real-time slashy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. How much are you expanding on what you've done before versus kind of starting from scratch as far as maybe design or even code goes?
In terms of technology or code, it's 0%. We did learn a lot each time, but this is, it has zero code in common with Moon Hunters. Mm-hmm. Now, in the future, hopefully, it'd be great if, you know, if we ever wanted to make another isometric dungeon crawler. Hopefully now we have an engine for that. Mm-hmm. But it's mostly design-wise. So in our minds, every time we definitely do, you know, postmortems for each game, and we try to learn as much as we can from the production, from the design, from the programming. But Moon Hunters was kind of our first big game. So we did some things. And I pleaded with the programmers, please, please, can we use this engine to make the next game? And they said, no, I will quit. No, not quite, but it was very much in no uncertain terms, no, you cannot make us do that. Mm-hmm. Here we are starting from scratch for this time, or we were a year ago starting from scratch. But I don't know, maybe we always will. Maybe that's how game development works. I don't know. Have you ever reused code successfully?
Other than like small, like, here's a script that tweens.
Yeah, we've done that, sure.
Every single game I make, because I'm a big, stupid idiot, is completely different. Absolutely nothing is reusable.
Our games are only really similar on the surface, though. Like yeah, we have little choices that you make A-B choices sometimes, or there's, you know, sword swinging. But when the camera angle's different, or the character size is different, or the run speed, like, everything ends up being so different.
Mm-hmm.
And you always end up hating your code a year later, so...
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to reuse code. I applaud the studios that manage to have that discipline.
Right.
I feel really dumb because... So you guys ask each other amazing questions, and this is the part of the podcast which we open this up to large talk, so like big philosophical mm-hmm. questions and stuff. But like, I've been taking notes while you guys are talking, and I have like really fluffy questions, such as, what was your first OTP? And you know what an OTP is? Ryan's giving me this face.
Is that like the ICP?
No, well, similar, if you think about it.
Wow.
So you are
wow.
clearly not on Tumblr. So let me explain this
to you. Oh, I just made
you.
A Tumblr for our Kickstarter. Yeah.
Well, welcome to the only good place on the internet. It's Tumblr. So, first of all, an OTP means one true pairing. So basically, you absorbed a body of fiction, whether it be a video game or a comic or a book or whatever, and you're like, these two people belong together. And it could be a canon pairing in which, like, during the course of the media, these two people come together, or a non-canon pairing, which means that you know in your heart and in your soul that the correct choice was for these two people to get together who didn't. So Tumblr is essentially a series of people talking about their OTPs. That's really it.
Mm-hmm.
Tanya and Ryan, who was your first OTP?
Honestly, the one that springs to mind as far as the first, because that's the important adjective here, is the first.
Right.
I don't know if it's like my strongest, but I read Lord of the Rings really young, like really, really young. Like I had to look up most of the words in the dictionary young. I was deeply, deeply into Aragorn and Eowyn.
Oh my God.
Like, I was extremely excited that they actually expanded Eowyn in the movie because...
Yeah. I was going to say, you poor thing.
All of my OTP-type feelings have all been forbidden loves that didn't work out, actually.
Oh, that's so sad and beautiful.
No, that's my favorite. It's my favorite when two people are in love and it's perfect and it doesn't work. That's, like, all of my favorite movies as well. Like, The Fountain, best movie.
As soon as you said Aragorn, I just like clutched my hands to my heart and I'm like swooning and I'm like, yes, that's exactly right. So Ryan, I mean, you are a man.
Correct.
Your feelings about OTPs are probably different because as a man, you are not encouraged to think about romance.
No, yeah, I was sitting here and I'm like, I am in full on panic attack. I'm sweating. I'm like, I don't know.
That's okay.
I really like two male characters that just really have each other's back. Hey, we trust each other to like kill orcs back to back and stuff like that, especially when they don't get along socially.
Are you about to say Gimli and Legolas?
No.
Oh, because Gimli and
no,
Legolas.
That's good. That's a good one.
They got a history, man.
That is one. I can't think of any because my brain just went into full on blank panic.
No, that counts. You know, like, I mean, everybody has different, we bloom at different times. So, Ryan,
yeah.
Perhaps you are yet to bloom, yeah. And your OTP has yet to show its face.
I mean, honestly, as I'm writing the characters of Boyfriend Dungeon, I mean, I'm trying to daydream as much as possible. This is the true pairing, you know, like what does it feel like to fall in love with this person,
right,
or this weapon? I mean, that's pretty inspirational to think about all the times in your life when you've gotten like a little bit too into a character.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Or like that you started like maybe consciously or subconsciously like being the character in real life. Did you ever hear about that? There's this article on like The Atlantic or something a few years back that was your favorite fictional character. You will start unconsciously like acting like
that
in
your
life. Like who?
The one I can think of right now is I watched all of Community and I picked up a lot of Abed's mannerisms, just kind of the curtness and the way he like turned his head. I would do that.
Tanya, you mentioned Brooklyn Nine-Nine earlier. I've begun to say cool, 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 cool.
Yeah, I wish I could, you know, have Rose's ferocity, but I am such an Amy that it's almost impossible.
I know that feel. I really do.
We all crush on Rosa, I assume.
Oh, of course. How could you not? Rose is a perfect person. So is Amy.
Yeah.
So is Captain Holt. So is that entire show. Okay, so I guess that's all my kissing questions. I think that us as you know, general millennial generation, we all have, like, we're all kind of in a constant state of existential dread.
Mm, yeah.
How are you dealing with your existential dread these days, Ryan?
I'm pretty fine.
Yeah.
I was like, all right, that's enough of that. That's not helping anything.
Yeah.
I'm pretty morbidly optimistic, so I'll be like, oh, my dog just turned 5 years old. He's halfway done.
Oh, no!
And people are like, no! And it's like, well, you know, I'd like to think, if I'm realistic about it, I'll appreciate when he is alive as opposed to ignoring the fact that at some point I will outlive him, hopefully.
As George Carlin used to say, buying a pet is like buying a small life tragedy. And it's true. But it is also like, you know, having somebody furry in your life that really loves you and doesn't care what kind of shit you talk and doesn't care what your job is, which is nice.
I mean, you can also adopt a small life tragedy for free from your local shelter.
Oh,
so
yeah.
Please do.
Well, yeah. Well, because when you adopt a dog or a cat from a shelter, you have to pay them. Except my cats I found in the trash for free. So I have one.
Perfect.
I have one cat free from an alley who was covered in his own boogers. And then I've got one cat that I got free from a shopping cart in a grocery store parking lot with three legs.
Both of my cats were rescues from the streets of Montreal.
This has been a wonderful conversation. So I have one last question, and it's just for Ryan. Ryan, do you do any impressions?
About this.
We were talking earlier, and we were talking about talking in a robot voice, and he freaked me out. He can do the speak and say or the spell?
Speak and spell?
Is it spell and say?
I don't
say?
Know. There was like a knockoff one. I don't know which one I had.
But you do like the freakiest robot voice.
Well, so you turn it on, and it goes,
welcome to speak and spell. Enter a word.
Wait, hold on. I have a bit that I like to do, but then I can end with that.
Yeah, that sounds good.
So I'm not going to do the whole bit, but I would always do like, I'd say to my friend, like, oh, fuck, I can't remember. But yeah, it was like,
I'm from the future. Would you like to receive this collect call?
What?
And then they say, like, yes. And then I'm like, and then it's just like a spam email with my robot voice. It's like,
penis enlargement can be yours for $9.95.
Something like that. I don't know. But yeah.
Well, you know, if you ever need a second job, that seems like a solid opportunity.
Yeah,
to be a robot voice?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Honestly, yeah. I mean, you're already in the games industry. So
yeah.
Now you
can impersonate a Vocaloid.
Ryan, do your voice thing. It'd be like, it was nice to meet you, Tanya. We are friends now.
Tanya, we are now friends.
Great work! Oh, I'm really happy for
nice.
You.
Nice.
Tanya and Ryan, thank you so much for coming. So if you could tell me two things. One, where people can find you personally on the internet, if you wish to be found. And two, just a recap of your game and what it's about. Let's start with Tanya.
Yeah, one, you can follow me on Twitter at TanyaXShort. Or you can email me at Tanya@KitFoxGames.com. But most importantly, you should look up Boyfriend Dungeon if you're interested in smooching swords, dating weapons, and generally having romantic dungeon crawly times. And you can find us on Twitter at KitFoxGames, or generally all the social medias at KitFoxGames. But definitely check out our Kickstarter right now. Thank you.
Yeah, and Ryan, tell us about you.
I can be found at Hatch Productions on Twitter. It's pretty much a combination of my personal and business account, so I'll make dumb jokes and pictures of sandwiches, but then also big updates about our games. Our Kickstarter is for Max Gentleman's Sexy Business. It is an absurd business tycoon and dating sim game. So go back it now. If you want to kiss a bevy of gentlemen and ladies.
I think we all got along this day. Thanks for listening.
Special thanks to Tanya of Boyfriend Dungeon and Ryan of Sexy Business who chatted with us today. And extra special thanks to our studio producer Alex Cox and Matt Connolly who wrote our theme song.